Chapter 3. The Planter. How 7% of a section within a nation ruled 5 million white people and owned 4 million black people and sought to make agriculture equal to industry through the rule of property without yielding political power or education to labor. 7% of the total population of the South in 1860 owned nearly 3 million of the 3,953,696 slaves. There was nearly as great a concentration of ownership in the best agricultural land. This meant that in a country predominantly agricultural, the ownership of labor, land, and capital was extraordinarily concentrated. Such peculiar organization of industry would have to be carefully reconciled with the new industrial and political democracy of the 19th century if it were to survive. Of the 5 million whites who owned no slaves, some were united in interest with the slave owners. These were overseers, drivers, and dealers in slaves. Others were hirers of white and black labor, and still others were merchants and professional men, forming a petty bourgeois class, and climbing up to the planter class, or falling down from it. The mass of the poor whites, as we have shown, were economic outcasts. Colonial Virginia declared its belief in natural and inalienable rights, popular sovereignty, and government for the common good, even before the Declaration of Independence, but it soon became the belief of doctrinaires, and not a single other Southern state enacted these doctrines of equality until after the Civil War. The Reconstruction constitutions incorporated them, but quite logically, South Carolina repudiated its declaration in 1895. The domination of property was shown in the qualifications for office and voting in the South. Southerners and others in the Constitutional Convention asked for property qualifications for the President of the United States, the federal judges, and senators. Most Southern state governments required a property qualification for the governor, and in South Carolina, he must be worth £10,000. Members of the legislature must usually be landowners. Plural voting was allowed as late as 1832. The requirement of the ownership of freehold land for office holders operated to the disadvantage of merchants and mechanics. In North Carolina, a man must own 50 acres to vote for senator, and in 1828, out of 250 voters at Wilmington, only 48 had the qualifications to vote for senator. Toward the time of the Civil War, many of these property qualifications disappeared. Into the hands of the slave owners, the political power of the South was concentrated by their social prestige, by property ownership, and also by their extraordinary rule of the counting of all, or at least 3/5, of the Negroes as part of the basis of representation in the legislature. It is singular how this 3/5 compromise was used, not only to degrade Negroes in theory, but in practice to disfranchise the white South. Nearly all of the Southern states began with recognizing the white population as a basis of representation. They afterward favored the Black Belt by direct legislation or by counting 3/5 of the slave population, and then finally by counting the whole black population. Or they established, as in Virginia and South Carolina, a mixed basis of representation based on white population and on property, that is, on land and slaves. In the distribution of seats in the legislature, this manipulation of political power appears. In the older states, representatives were assigned arbitrarily to counties, districts, and towns, with little regard to population. This was for the purpose of putting the control in the hands of wealthy planters. Variations from this were the basing of representation on the white population in one house and taxation in the other, or the use of the federal proportion, that is, free persons and 3/5 of the slaves, or federal proportion and taxation combined. These were all manipulated so as to favor the wealthy planters. The commercial class secured scant representation as compared with agriculture. It is a fact that the political working of the state of South Carolina is in the hands of 150 to 180 men. It has taken me 6 months to appreciate the entireness of the fact, though, of course, I had heard it stated. In all cases, the slaveholder practically voted both for himself and his slaves, and it was not until 1850, and particularly after the war, that there were signs of self-assertion on the part of the poor whites to break this monopoly of power. Alabama, for instance, in 1850, based representation in the General Assembly upon the white inhabitants, after 30 years of counting the whole white and black population. Thus, the Southern planters had in their hands from 1820 to the Civil War political power equivalent to 1 or 2 million freemen in the North. They fought bitterly during the early stages of Reconstruction to retain this power for the whites, while at the same time granting no political power to the blacks. Finally, and up to this day, by making good their efforts to disfranchise the blacks, the political heirs of the planters still retain for themselves this added political representation as a legacy from slavery and a power to frustrate all third-party movements. Thus, the planters who owned from 50 to 1,000 slaves and from 1,000 to 10,000 acres of land came to fill the whole picture in the South, and literature and the propaganda, which is usually called history, have since exaggerated that picture. The planter certainly dominated politics and social life. He boasted of his education, but on the whole, these Southern leaders were men singularly ignorant of modern conditions and trends and of their historical background. All their ideas of gentility and education went back to the days of European privilege and caste. They cultivated a surface acquaintance with literature, and they threw Latin quotations even into Congress. Some few had a cultural education at Princeton and at Yale, and to this day, Princeton refuses to receive Negro students, and Yale has admitted a few with reluctance as a curious legacy from slavery. Many Southerners traveled abroad, and the fashionable European world met almost exclusively Americans from the South and were favorably impressed by their manners, which contrasted with the gaucherie of the average Northerner. A Southerner of the upper class could enter a drawing room and carry on a light conversation and eat according to the rules, on tables covered with silver and fine linen. They were gentlemen, according to the older and more meager connotation of the word. Southern women of the planter class had little formal education. They were trained in dependence, with a smattering of French and music. They affected the latest European styles, were always described as beautiful, and of course must do no work for a living except in the organization of their households. In this latter work, they were assisted and even impeded by more servants than they needed. The temptations of this sheltered, exotic position called the finer possibilities of womanhood into exercise only in exceptional cases. It was the women on the edge of the inner circles and those of the struggling poor whites who sought to enter the ranks of the privileged who showed superior character. Most of the planters, like most Americans, were of humble descent, two or three generations removed. Jefferson Davis was a grandson of a poor Welsh immigrant. Yet the Southerners' assumptions impressed the North, and although most of them were descended from the same social classes as the Yankees, yet the Yankees had more recently been reinforced by emigration and were strenuous, hard-working men, ruthlessly pushing themselves into the leadership of the new industry. Such folk not only love a lord, but even the fair imitation of one. The leaders of the South had a leisure for good breeding and high living, and before them Northern society abased itself and flattered and fawned over them. Perhaps this, more than ethical reasons, or even economic advantage, made the way of the abolitionist hard. In New York, Saratoga, Philadelphia, and Cincinnati, a slave baron, with his fine raiment, gorgeous and doll-like women, and black flunkies, quite turned the heads of Northern society. Their habits of extravagance impressed the nation for a long period. Much of the waste charged against Reconstruction arose from the attempt of the post-war population, white and black, to imitate the manners of a slave-nurtured gentility, and this brought furious protest from former planters, because while planters spent money filched from the labor of black slaves, the poor white and black leaders of Reconstruction spent taxes drawn from recently impoverished planters. From an economic point of view, this planter class had interest in consumption rather than production. They exploited labor in order that they themselves should live more grandly, and not mainly for increasing production. Their taste went to elaborate households, well-furnished and hospitable. They had much to eat and drink. They consumed large quantities of liquor. They gambled and caroused and kept up the habit of dueling well down into the 19th century. Sexually, they were lawless, protecting elaborately and flattering the virginity of a small class of women of their social clan and keeping at command millions of poor women of the two laboring groups of the South. Sexual chaos was always the possibility of slavery, not always realized, but always possible. Polygamy through the concubinage of black women to white men. Polandry between black women and selected men on plantations in order to improve the human stock of strong and able workers. The census of 1860 counted 588,352 persons, obviously of mixed blood, a figure admittedly below the truth. Every man who resides on his plantation may have his harem, and has every inducement of custom and of pecuniary gain. The law declares that the children of slaves are to follow the fortunes of the mother, hence the practice of planters selling and bequeathing their own children, to tempt him to the common practice. Those who, notwithstanding, keep their homes undefiled may be considered as of incorruptible purity. Mrs. Trollope speaks of the situation of New Orleans mulattoes. Of all the prejudices I have ever witnessed, this appears to us the most violent and the most inveterate. Quadroon girls, the acknowledged daughters of wealthy American or Creole fathers, educated with all the style and accomplishments which money can procure at New Orleans, and with all the decorum that care and affection can give, exquisitely beautiful, graceful, gentle, and amiable, are not admitted, nay, are not in any terms admissible into the society of the Creole families of Louisiana. They cannot marry. That is to say, no ceremony can render any union with them legal or binding. It is known by almost everybody who has heard of the man, Richard M. Johnson, a Democratic Vice President of the United States, that he had colored daughters of whom he was proud, and his was not an exceptional case. Several presidents of the United States have been accused of racial catholicity in sex. And finally, one cannot forget that bitter word attributed to a sister of a president of the United States. We Southern ladies are complimented with names of wives, but we are only mistresses of seraglios. What the planters wanted was income large enough to maintain the level of living which was their ideal. Naturally, only a few of them had enough for this, and the rest, striving toward it, were perpetually in debt and curiously seeking a reason for this indebtedness outside themselves. Since it was beneath the dignity of a gentleman to encumber himself with the details of his finances, this lordly excuse enabled the planter to place between himself and the black slave a series of intermediaries, through whom bitter pressure and exploitation could be exercised and large crops raised. For the very reason that the planters did not give attention to details, there was wide tendency to commercialize their growing business of supplying raw materials for an expanding modern industry. They were the last to comprehend the revolution through which that industry was passing, and their efforts to increase income succeeded only at the cost of raping the land and degrading the laborers. Theoretically, there were many ways of increasing the income of the planter. Practically, there was but one. The planter might sell his crops at higher prices. He might increase his crop by intensive farming, or he might reduce the cost of handling and transporting his crops. He might increase his crops by making his laborers work harder and giving them smaller wages. In practice, the planter, so far as prices were concerned, was at the mercy of the market. Merchants and manufacturers, by intelligence and close combination, set the current prices of raw material. Their power thus exercised over agriculture was not unlimited, but it was so large, so continuous, and so steadily and intelligently exerted that it gradually reduced agriculture to a subsidiary industry whose returns scarcely supported the farmer and his labor. The Southern planter in the 50s was in a key position to attempt to break and arrest the growth of his domination of all industry by trade and manufacture, but he was too lazy and self-indulgent to do this, and he would not apply his intelligence to the problem. His capitalistic rivals of the North were hard-working, simple-living zealots, devoting their whole energy and intelligence to building up an industrial system. They quickly monopolized transport and mines and factories, and they were more than willing to include the big plantations. But the planter wanted results without effort. He wanted large income without corresponding investment, and he insisted furiously upon a system of production which excluded intelligent labor, machinery, and modern methods. He toyed with the idea of local manufacturers and ships and railroads, but this entailed too much work and sacrifice. The result was that Northern and European industry set prices for Southern cotton, tobacco, and sugar, which left a narrow margin of profit for the planter. He could retaliate only by more ruthlessly exploiting his slave labor so as to get the largest crops at the least expense. He was therefore not deliberately cruel to his slaves, but he had to raise cotton enough to satisfy his pretensions and self-indulgence, even if it brutalized and commercialized his slave labor. Thus, slavery was the economic lag of the 16th century, carried over into the 19th century, and bringing by contrast and by friction moral lapses and political difficulties. It has been estimated that the Southern states had, in 1860, $3 billion invested in slaves, which meant that slaves and land represented the mass of their capital. Being generally convinced that Negroes could only labor as slaves, it was easy for them to become further persuaded that slaves were better off than white workers, and that the South had a better labor system than the North, with extraordinary possibilities in industrial and social development. The argument went like this. Raw material like cotton, tobacco, sugar, rice, together with foodstuffs, formed the real wealth of the United States and were produced by the Southern states. These crops were sold all over the world and were in such demand that the industry of Europe depended upon them. The trade with Europe must be kept open so that the South might buy at the lowest prices such manufactured goods as she wanted, and she must oppose all Northern attempts to exalt industry at the expense of agriculture. The North might argue cogently that industry and manufacture could build up in the United States a national economy. Writers on economics began in Germany and America to elaborate and insist upon the advantages of such a system, but the South would have none of it. It meant not only giving the North a new industrial prosperity, but doing this at the expense of England and France, and the Southern planters preferred Europe to Northern America. They not only preferred Europe for social reasons and for economic advantages, but they sensed that the new power of monopolizing and distributing capital through a national banking system, if permitted in the North, in an expanding industry, would make the North an even greater financial dictator of the South than it was at the time. The South voiced for the Southern farmer in 1850 words almost identical with those of the Western farmer 75 years later. All industry, declared one Southerner, is getting legislative support against agriculture, and thus the profits are going to manufacture and trade, and these concentrated in the North stand against the interests of the South. It could not perhaps be proven that the Southern planter, had he been educated in economics and history, and had he known the essential trends of the modern world, could have kept the Industrial Revolution from subordinating agriculture and reducing it to its present vassalage to manufacturing. But it is certain that an enlightened and far-seeing agrarianism under the peculiar economic circumstances of the United States during the first half of the 19th century could have essentially modified the economic trend of the world. The South, with free rich land and cheap labor, had the monopoly of cotton, a material in universal demand. If the leaders of the South, while keeping the consumer in mind, had turned more thoughtfully to the problem of the American producer and had guided the production of cotton and food so as to take every advantage of new machinery and modern methods in agriculture, they might have moved forward with manufacture and been able to secure an approximately large amount of profit. This would have involved yielding to the demands of modern labor, opportunity for education, legal protection of women and children, regulation of the hours of work, steadily increasing wages, and the right to some voice in the administration of the state, if not in the conduct of industry. The South had but one argument against following modern civilization in this yielding to the demand of laboring humanity. It insisted on the efficiency of Negro labor for ordinary toil, and on its essential equality in physical condition with the average labor of Europe and America. But in order to maintain its income without sacrifice or exertion, the South fell back on a doctrine of racial differences, which it asserted made higher intelligence and increased efficiency impossible for Negro labor. Wishing such an excuse for lazy indulgence, the planter easily found, invented, and proved it. His subservient religious leaders reverted to the curse of Canaan. His pseudoscientists gathered and supplemented all available doctrines of race inferiority. His scattered schools and pedantic periodicals repeated these legends until, for the average planter born after 1840, it was impossible not to believe that all valid laws in psychology, economics, and politics stopped with the Negro race. The espousal of the doctrine of Negro inferiority by the South was primarily because of economic motives and the interconnected political urge necessary to support slave industry. But to the watching world, it sounded like the carefully thought-out result of experience and reason. And because of this, it was singularly disastrous for modern civilization in science and religion, in art and government, as well as in industry. The South could say that the Negro, even when brought into modern civilization, could not be civilized, and that, therefore, he and the other colored peoples of the world were so far inferior to the whites that the white world had a right to rule mankind for their own selfish interests. Never in modern times has a large section of a nation so used its combined energies to the degradation of mankind. The hurt to the Negro in this era was not only his treatment in slavery, it was the wound dealt to his reputation as a human being. Nothing was left. Nothing was sacred. And while the best and more cultivated and more humane of the planters did not themselves always repeat the calumny, they stood by, consenting by silence, while blatherskites said things about Negroes too cruelly untrue to be the word of civilized men. Not only then in the 40s and 50s did the word Negro lose its capital letter, but African history became the tale of degraded animals and subhuman savages where no vestige of human culture found foothold. Thus, a basis in reason, philanthropy, and science was built up for Negro slavery. Judges on the bench declared that Negro servitude was to last, if the apocalypse be not in error, until the end of time. The Atlanta Daily Intelligencer of January 9, 1860, said, "We can't see for the life of us how anyone understanding fully the great principle that underlies our system of involuntary servitude can discover any monstrosity in subjecting a Negro to slavery of a white man. We contend, on the contrary, that the monstrosity, or at least the unnaturalness in this matter, consists in finding Negroes anywhere in white communities not under the control of the whites. Whenever we see a Negro, we presuppose a master, and if we see him in what is commonly called a free state, we consider him out of his place. This matter of manumission, or emancipation, now, thank heaven, less practiced than formerly, is a species of false philanthropy, which we look upon as a cousin german to abolitionism, bad for the master, worse for the slave." Beneath this educational and social propaganda lay the undoubted evidence of the planter's own expenses. He saw ignorant and sullen labor deliberately reducing his profits. In fact, he always faced the negative attitude of the general strike. Open revolt of slaves, refusal to work, could be met by beating and selling to the harsher methods of the Deep South and Southwest as punishment. Running away could be curbed by law and police. But nothing could stop the dogged slave for doing just as little and as poor work as possible. All observers spoke of the fact that the slaves were slow and churlish, that they wasted material and malingered at their work. Of course they did. This was not racial, but economic. It was the answer of any group of laborers forced down to the last ditch. They might be made to work continuously, but no power could make them work well. If the European or northern laborer did not do his work properly and fast enough, he would lose the job. The black slave could not lose his job. If the northern laborer got sick or injured, he was discharged, usually without compensation. The black slave could not be discharged and had to be given some care in sicknesses, particularly if he represented a valuable investment. The northern and English employer could select workers in the prime of life and did not have to pay children too young to work or adults too old. The slave owner had to take care of children and old folk, and while this did not cost much on a farm or entail any great care, it did seriously cut down the proportion of his effective laborers, which could only be balanced by the systematic labor of women and children. The children ran loose with only the most general control, getting their food with the other slaves. The old folk foraged for themselves. Now and then they were found dead of neglect, but usually there was no trouble in their getting at least food enough to live and some rude shelter. The economic difficulties that thus faced the planter in exploiting the black slave were curious. Contrary to the trend of his age, he could not use higher wage to induce better work or a larger supply of labor. He could not allow his labor to become intelligent, although intelligent labor would greatly increase the production of wealth. He could not depend on voluntary immigration unless the immigrants be slaves, and he must bear the burden of the old and sick, and could only balance this by child labor and the labor of women. The use of slave women as day workers naturally broke up or made impossible the normal Negro home, and this and the slave code led to a development of which the South was really ashamed, and which it often denied, and yet perfectly evident. The raising of slaves in the border slave states for a systematic sale on the commercialized cotton plantations. The ability of the slaveholder and landlord to sequester a large share of the profits of slave labor depended upon his exploitation of that labor, rather than upon high prices for his product in the market. In the world market, the merchants and manufacturers had all the advantage of unity, knowledge, and purpose, and could hammer down the price of raw material. The slaveholder, therefore, saw northern merchants and manufacturers enrich themselves from the results of southern agriculture. He was angry and used all of his great political power to circumvent it. His only effective economic movement, however, could take place against the slave. He was forced, unless willing to take lower profits, continually to beat down the cost of his slave labor. But there was another motive which more and more, strongly as time went on, compelled the planter to cling to slavery. His political power was based on slavery. With 4 million slaves, he could balance the votes of 2,400,000 northern voters, while in the inconceivable event of their becoming free, their votes would outnumber those of his northern opponents, which was precisely what happened in 1868. As the economic power of the planter waned, his political power became more and more indispensable to the maintenance of his income and profits. Holding his industrial system secure by his political domination, the planter turned to the more systematic exploitation of his black labor. One method called for more land, and the other for more slaves. Both meant not only increased crops, but increased political power. It was a temptation that swept greed, religion, military pride, and dreams of empire to its defense. There were two possibilities. He might follow the old method of the early West Indian sugar plantations, work his slaves without regard to their physical condition until they died of overwork or exposure, and then buy new ones. The difficulty of this, however, was that the price of slaves, since the attempt to abolish the slave trade, was gradually rising. This in the Deep South led to a strong and gradually increasing demand for the reopening of the African slave trade, just as modern industry demands cheaper and cheaper coolie labor in Asia and half-slave labor in African mines. The other possibility was to find continual increments of new, rich land, upon which ordinary slave labor would bring adequate return. This land the South sought in the Southeast, then beyond the Mississippi, in Louisiana and Texas, then in Mexico, and finally it turned its face in two directions, toward the northwestern territories of the United States and toward the West Indian Islands and South America. The South was drawn toward the West by two motives. First, the possibility that slavery in Kansas, Colorado, Utah, and Nevada would be at least as profitable as in Missouri. And secondly, to prevent the expansion of free labor there and its threat to slavery. This challenge was a council of despair in the face of modern industrial development, and probably the radical South expected defeat in the West and hoped the consequent resentment among the slaveholders would set the South toward a great slave empire in the Caribbean. Jefferson Davis was ready to reopen the African slave trade to any future acquisition south of the Rio Grande. This brought the South to war with the farmers and laborers in the North and West, who wanted free soil but did not want to compete with slave labor. The Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 vastly extended federal power so as to nullify state rights in the North. The Compromise of 1850 permitted the extension of slavery into the territories, and the Kansas-Nebraska Bill, 1854, deprived Congress of the right to prohibit slavery anywhere. This opened the entire West to slavery. War followed in Kansas. Slaveholders went boldly into Kansas, armed and organized. The invaders went in such force that the scattered and unorganized citizens could make no resistance, and in many places they did not attempt to vote, seeing the polls surrounded by crowds of armed men who they knew came from Missouri to control the election. And the leaders of the invaders kept their men under control, being anxious to prevent needless violence, as any serious outbreak would attract the attention of the country. In some districts, the actual citizens protested against the election and petitioned the governor to set it aside and order another. We can tell the impertinent scoundrels of the Tribune that we will continue to lynch and hang, to tar and feather, and drown every white-livered abolitionist who dares to pollute our soil. Shut out from the United States territories by the Free Soil Movement, the South determined upon secession, with the distinct idea of eventually expanding into the Caribbean. There was, however, the opposition in the border states. The employers of labor in the border states had found a new source of revenue. They did not like to admit it. They surrounded it with a certain secrecy, and it was exceedingly bad taste for any Virginia planter to have it indicated that he was deliberately raising slaves for sale. And yet, that was a fact. In no respect are the peculiar psychological difficulties of the planter better illustrated than with regard to the interstate slave trade. The theory was clear and lofty. Slaves were a part of the family, my people, George Washington called them. Under ordinary circumstances, they were never to be alienated, but supported during good behavior and bad, punished and corrected for crime and misdemeanor, rewarded for good conduct. It was the patriarchal clan translated into modern life, with social, religious, economic, and even blood ties. This was the theory, but as a matter of fact, the cotton planters were supplied with laborers by the border states. A laboring stock was deliberately bred for legal sale. A large number of persons followed the profession of promoting this sale of slaves. There were markets and quotations, and the stream of black labor moving continuously into the South reached nearly into the thousands. Notwithstanding these perfectly clear and authenticated facts, the planter persistently denied them. He denied that there was any considerable interstate sale of slaves. He denied that families were broken up. He insisted that slave auctions were due to death or mischance, and particularly did he insist that the slave traders were the least of human beings and most despised. This deliberate contradiction of plain facts constitutes itself a major charge against slavery and shows how the system often so affronted the moral sense of the planters themselves that they tried to hide from it, They could not face the fact of Negro women as brood mares, and of black children as puppies. Indeed, while we speak of the planters as one essentially unvarying group, there is evidence that the necessities of their economic organization were continually changing and deteriorating their morale and pushing forward ruder, noisier, less cultivated elements than characterized the Southern gentlemen of earlier days. Certainly, the cursing, brawling, whoring gamblers who largely represented the South in the late 50s evidenced the inevitable deterioration that overtakes men when their desire for income and extravagance overwhelms their respect for human beings. Thus, the interstate slave trade grew and flourished, and the demand for the African slave trade was rapidly becoming irresistible in the late 50s. From 50 to 80,000 slaves went from the border states to the lower South in the last decade of slavery. One planter frankly said that he calculated that the moment a colored baby was born, it was worth to him $300. So far as possible, the planters, in selling off their slaves, avoided the breaking up of families, but they were facing flat economic facts. The persons who were buying slaves in the Cotton Belt were not buying families, they were buying workers, and thus, by economic demand, families were continually and regularly broken up. The father was sold away. The mother and the half-grown children separated, and sometimes smaller children were sold. One of the subsequent tragedies of the system was the frantic efforts before and after emancipation of Negroes hunting for their relatives throughout the United States. A Southerner wrote to Olmsted, "In the states of Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Missouri, as much attention is paid to the breeding and growth of Negroes as to that of horses and mules. Further south, we raise them both for use and for market. Planters command their girls and women, married or unmarried, to have children. And I have known a great many Negro girls to be sold off because they did not have children. A breeding woman is worth from 1/6 to 1/4 more than one that does not breed." Sexual chaos arose from economic motives. The deliberate breeding of a strong, big field hand stock could be carried out by selecting proper males and giving them the run of the likeliest females. This, in many border states, became a regular policy and fed the slave trade. Childbearing was a profitable occupation, which received every possible encouragement, and there was not only no bar to illegitimacy, but an actual premium put upon it. Indeed, the word was impossible of meaning under the slave system. Moncure D. Conway, whose father was a slaveholder near Fredericksburg, Virginia, wrote, "As a general thing, the chief pecuniary resource in the border states is the breeding of slaves. And I grieve to say that there is too much ground for the charges that general licentiousness among the slaves, for the purpose of a large increase, is compelled by some masters and encouraged by many. The period of maternity is hastened, the average youth of Negro mothers being nearly 3 years earlier than that of any free race, and an old maid is utterly unknown among the women." J. E. Cans, the English economist, in his passage with Mr. McHenry on this subject, computed from reliable data that Virginia had bred and exported to the cotton states between the years of 1840 and 1850 no less than 100,000 slaves, which at $500 per head would have yielded her $50 million. The law sometimes forbade the breaking up of slave families, but not one of these prohibitions, save those of Louisiana, and they but slightly, in any way referred to or hampered the owner of unencumbered slave property. He might sell or pawn or mortgage or give it away according to profit or whim, regardless of age or kinship. Elsewhere in the typical South, in Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Texas, there seems to have been no restriction of any sort against separating mothers and children, or husbands and wives, or selling children of any age. Slavery was, indeed, a peculiar institution. The slave trading board of states, therefore, in their own economic interest, practically defended slavery, yet opposed the reopening of the African slave trade, to which the Southern South was becoming more and more attracted. This slave trade had curious psychological effects upon the planter. When George Washington sold a slave to the West Indies for one hogshead of best rum and molasses and sweetmeats, it was because this fellow is both a rogue and a runaway. Thus tradition grew up that the sale of a slave from a gentleman's plantation was for special cause. As time went on, and slavery became systematized and commercialized under the Cotton Kingdom, this was absolutely untrue. The buying or selling of slaves was not viewed as having any taint of hated slave trading, yet it early became a fully credited tradition, implicitly accepted generation after generation, that all traders were hated. The sacrifices necessary for economic advance, Southern planters were on the whole too selfish and too provincial to make. They would not in any degree curtail consumption in order to furnish at least part of the necessary increase of capital and make dependence upon debt to the North and to Europe less necessary. They did not socialize the ownership of the slave on any large scale or educate him in technique. They did not encourage local and auxiliary industry or manufacture, and thus make it possible for their own profit to exploit white labor and give it an economic foothold. This would have involved, to be sure, increased recognition of democracy, and far from yielding to any such inevitable development, the South threw itself into the arms of a reaction at least two centuries out of date. Governor McDuffie of South Carolina called the laboring class, bleached or unbleached, a dangerous element in the population. A curious argument appeared in the Charleston Mercury of 1861. Within 10 years past, as many as 10,000 slaves have been drawn away from Charleston by the attractive prices of the West, and white laborers from abroad have come to take their places. These laborers have every disposition to work above the slave, and if there were opportunity, would be glad to do so. But without such opportunity, they come into competition with him. They are necessarily restive to the contact. Already there is disposition to exclude him from the trades, from public works, from drays, and the tables of the hotels. He is even now excluded to a great extent, and when more laborers shall come in greater numbers to the South, they will still more increase the tendency to exclusion. They will question the right of masters to employ their slaves in any work that they may wish for. They will invoke the aid of legislation. They will use the elective franchise to that end. They will acquire the power to determine municipal elections. They will inexorably use it, and thus the town of Charleston, at the very heart of slavery, may become a fortress of democratic power against it. The planters entirely misconceived the extent to which democracy was spreading in the North. They thought it meant that the laboring class was going to rule the North for labor's own economic interests. Even those who saw the seamy side of slavery were convinced of the rightness of the system because they believed that there were seeds of disaster in the North against which slavery would be their protection. Indications that these are already beginning to be felt, or anticipated by prophetic minds, they think they see in the demands for land limitation, in the anti-rent troubles, in strikes of workmen, in the distress of immigrants at the eddies of their current, in diseased philanthropy, in radical democracy, and in the progress of socialistic ideas in general. The North, they say, has progressed under the high pressure of unlimited competition. As the population grows denser, there will be terrific explosions, disaster, and ruin, while they will ride quietly and safely to the anchor of slavery. Thus the planters of the South walked straight into the face of modern economic progress. The North had yielded to democracy, but only because democracy was curbed by a dictatorship of property and investment, which left in the hands of the leaders of industry such economic power as ensured their mastery and their profits. Less than this, they knew perfectly well they could not yield, and more than this, they would not. They remained masters of the economic destiny of America. In the South, on the other hand, the planters walked in quite the opposite direction, excluding the poor whites from nearly every economic foothold with apparently no conception of the danger these 5 million workers, who in time overthrew the planters and utterly submerged them after the Civil War. And the South was equally determined to regard its 4 million slaves as a class of submerged workers, and to this ideal they and their successors still cling. Calhoun once said with perfect truth, "There has never yet existed a wealthy and civilized society in which one portion of the community did not, in point of fact, live on the labor of the other." Governor McDuffie of South Carolina said, "God forbid that my descendants, in the remotest generations, should live in any other than a community having the institution of domestic slavery." The South elected to make its fight through the political power which it possessed because of slavery and the disfranchisement of the poor whites. It had in American history chosen 11 out of 16 presidents, 16 out of 28 judges of the Supreme Court, 14 out of 19 attorneys general, 21 out of 33 speakers of the House, 80 out of 134 foreign ministers. It demanded a fugitive slave law as strong as words could make it, and it was offered constitutional guarantees which would have made it impossible for the North to meddle with the organization of the slave empire. The South was assured of all the territory southwest of Missouri and as far as California. It might even have extended its imperialistic sway toward the Caribbean without effective opposition from the North or Europe. The South had conquered Mexico without help, and beyond laid the rest of Mexico, the West Indies, and South America open to Southern imperialistic enterprise. The South dominated the army and navy. It argued that a much larger proportion of the population could go to war in the South than in the North. There might, of course, be danger of slave insurrection in a long war with actual invasion, but the possibility of a long war or any war at all, Southerners discounted, and they looked confidently forward to being either an independent section of the United States or an independent country with a stable economic foundation which could dictate its terms to the modern world on the basis of a monopoly of cotton and a large production of other essential raw materials. The South was too ignorant to know that their only chance to establish such economic dictatorship and place themselves in a key economic position was through a national economy, in a large nation where a home market would absorb a large proportion of the production, and where agriculture, led by men of vision, could demand a fair share of profit from industry. When, therefore, the planters surrendered this chance and went to war with the machine to establish agricultural independence, they lost because of their internal weakness. Their whole labor class, black and white, went into economic revolt. The breach could only have been healed by making the same concessions to labor that France, England, Germany, and the North had made. There was no time for such change in the midst of war. Northern industry must, therefore, after the war, make the adjustment with labor which Southern agriculture refused to make. But the loss which agriculture sustained through the stubbornness of the planters led to the degradation of agriculture throughout the modern world. Due to the stubbornness of the South and the capitalism of the West, we have had built up in the world an agriculture with a minimum of machines and new methods, conducted by ignorant labor, and producing raw materials used by industry equipped with machines and intelligent labor, and conducted by shrewd businessmen. The result has been that a disproportionate part of the profit of organized work has gone to industry, while the agricultural laborer has descended toward slavery. The West, instead of becoming a country of peasant proprietors who might have counteracted this result, surrendered itself hand and foot to capitalism and speculation in land. The abolition of American slavery started the transportation of capital from white to black countries where slavery prevailed, with the same tremendous and awful consequences upon the laboring classes of the world which we see about us today. When raw material could not be raised in a country like the United States, it could be raised in the tropics and semi-tropics under a dictatorship of industry, commerce, and manufacture, and with no free farming class. The competition of a slave-directed agriculture in the West Indies and South America, in Africa and Asia, eventually ruined the economic efficiency of agriculture in the United States and in Europe, and precipitated the modern economic degradation of the white farmer, while it put into the hands of the owners of the machine such a monopoly of raw material that their domination of white labor was more and more complete. The crisis came in 1860, not so much because Abraham Lincoln was elected president on a platform which refused further land for the expansion of slavery, but because the cotton crop of 1859 reached the phenomenal height of 5 million bales, as compared with 3 million in 1850. To this was added the threat of radical abolition, as represented by John Brown. The South feared these social upheavals, but it was spurred to immediate action by the great cotton crop. Starting with South Carolina, the Southern cotton-raising and slave-consuming states were forced out of the Union. Their reason for doing this was clearly stated and reiterated. For a generation, belief in slavery was the Southern shibboleth. A suspicion of heresy on the subject of the peculiar institution was sufficient to declare the ineligibility of any candidate for office. Nay, more, orthodoxy began to depend upon the correct attitude toward the doctrine of squatter sovereignty and the extreme view held as to federal protection of slavery in the territories. Jefferson Davis said that the North was impairing the security of property and slaves and reducing those states which held slaves to a condition of inferiority. Senator Toombs said that property and slaves must be entitled to the same protection from the government as any other property. The South Carolina Convention arraigned the North for increasing hostility to the institution of slavery and declared for secession because the North had assumed the right of deciding upon the propriety of Southern domestic institutions. Governor R.C. Wickliffe, in his message at the extra session of the legislature of Louisiana, expressed his belief that the election was a deliberate design to pervert the powers of the government to the immediate injury and ultimate destruction of the peculiar institution of the South. Slidell's farewell speech in the Congressional Globe of February 5, 1861, "We separate," he said, "because of the hostility of Lincoln to our institutions. If he were inaugurated without our consent, there would be slave insurrections in the South." The Alabama commissioner to Maryland arraigned the Lincoln government as proposing not to recognize the right of the Southern citizens to property in the labor of African slaves. The governor of Alabama arraigned the Republicans for desiring the destruction of the institution of slavery. In the Southern Congress, at Montgomery on the 2nd of February, 1861, Senator Wigfall from Texas said that he was fighting for slavery and for nothing else. The patent of nobility is in the color of the skin. He wanted to live in no country in which a man who blacked his boots and curried his horse was his equal. Give Negroes muskets and make them soldiers, and the next subject introduced for discussion will be miscegenation. And finally, Alexander H. Stephens, Vice President of the Confederacy, stated fully the philosophy of the new Confederate government. "The new Constitution has put at rest forever all the agitating questions relating to our peculiar institutions, African slavery as it exists among us, the proper status of the Negro in our form of civilization. This was the immediate cause of the late rupture and present revolution." Jefferson, in his forecast, had anticipated this as the rock upon which the old Union would split. He was right. What was conjecture with him is now a realized fact. But whether he fully comprehended the great truth upon which that rock stood and stands may be doubted. The prevailing ideas entertained by him and most of the leading statesmen at the time of the formation of the old Constitution were that the enslavement of the African was in violation of the laws of nature, that it was wrong in principle, socially, morally, and politically. It was an evil they knew not well how to deal with, but the general opinion of the men of that day was that somehow or other, in the order of providence, the institution would be evanescent and pass away. Those ideas, however, were fundamentally wrong. They rested upon the assumption of the equality of races. This was an error. It was a sandy foundation, and the idea of a government built upon it. When the storm came and the winds blew, it fell. Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests, upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man. That slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical and moral truth. This truth has been slow in the process of its development, like all other truths in the various departments of science. It has been so even amongst us. Many who hear me, perhaps, can recollect well that this truth was not generally admitted, even within their day. Now they are universally acknowledged. May we not, therefore, look with confidence to the ultimate universal acknowledgement of the truths upon which our system rests? It is the first government ever instituted upon principles of strict conformity to nature and the ordination of providence in furnishing the materials of human society. Many governments have been founded upon the principle of certain classes, but the classes thus enslaved were of the same race, and in violation of the laws of nature. Our system commits no such violation of nature's laws. The Negro, by nature, or by the curse against Canaan, is fitted for that condition which he occupies in our system. The architect, in the construction of buildings, lays the foundation with the proper materials, the granite. Then comes the brick or the marble. The substratum of our society is made of the material fitted by nature for it, and by experience we know that it is best, not only for the superior, but for the inferior race, that it should be so. It is, indeed, in conformity with the ordinance of the Creator. It is not for us to inquire into the wisdom of His ordinances, or to question them. For His own purposes He has made one race to differ from another, as he has had one star to differ from another star in glory. The rift between the Southern South and the border states was bridged by omission of all reference to the reopening of the slave trade and stressing the reality of the Northern attack upon the institution of slavery itself. The movement against the slave trade laws in the Southern South was strong and growing. In 1854, a grand jury in the Williamsburg District of South Carolina declared, as our unanimous opinion, that the federal law abolishing the African slave trade is a public grievance. We hold this trade has been, and would be, if reestablished, a blessing to the American people and a benefit to the African himself. 2 years later, the governor of the state in his annual message argued for a reopening of the trade, and declared, if we cannot supply the demand for slave labor, then we must expect to be supplied with a species of labor we do not want, that is, free white labor. The movement was forwarded by the commercial conventions. In 1855, at New Orleans, a resolution for the repeal of the slave trade laws was introduced, but not reported by committee. In 1856, at Savannah, the convention refused to debate the matter of the repeal of the slave trade laws, but appointed a committee. At the convention at Knoxville in 1857, a resolution declaring it inexpedient to reopen the trade was voted down. At Montgomery in 1858, a committee presented an elaborate majority report declaring it expedient and proper that the foreign slave trade should be reopened. After debate, it was decided that it was inexpedient for any single state to attempt to reopen the African slave trade while that state is one of the United States of America. Finally, at Vicksburg in 1859, it was voted 40-19 that all laws, state or federal, prohibiting the African slave trade ought to be repealed. Both the provisional and permanent constitutions of the Confederate States forbade the importation of Negroes from foreign countries, except the slaveholding states, or territories of the United States of America. Nevertheless, the foreign ministers of the Confederate States were assured that while the Confederate government had no power to reopen the slave trade, the states could, if they wanted to, and that the ministers were not to discuss any treaties to prohibit the trade. Thus, the planters led the South into war, carrying the 5 million poor whites blindly with them and standing upon a creed which opposed the free distribution of government land, which asked for the expansion of slave territory, for restricted functions of the national government, and for the perpetuity of Negro slavery. What irritated the planter and made him charge the North and liberal Europe with hypocrisy was the ethical implications of slavery. He was kept explaining a system of work which he insisted was no different in essence from that in vogue in Europe and the North. They and he were all exploiting labor. He did it by individual right, they by state law. They called their labor free. But after all, the laborer was only free to starve if he did not work on their terms. They called his laborer a slave when his master was responsible for him from birth to death. The Southern argument had strong backing in the commercial North. Lawyer O'Connor of New York expressed amid applause that calm, reasoned estimate of the Negro in 1859 which pervaded the North. Now, gentlemen, nature itself has assigned his condition of servitude to the Negro. He has the strength and is fit to work. But nature, which gave him his strength, denied him both the intelligence to rule and the will to work. Both are denied to him. And the same nature which denied him the will to work gave him a master who should enforce his will and make a useful servant of him in a climate to which he is well adapted for his own benefit and that of the master who rules him. I assert that it is no injustice to leave the Negro in the position into which nature placed him, to put a master over him. And he is not robbed of any right if he is compelled to labor in return for this, and to supply a just compensation for his master in return for the labor and the talents devoted to ruling him and to making him useful to himself and to society. What the planter and his northern apologist did not readily admit was that this exploitation of labor reduced it to a wage so low and a standard of living so pitiable that no modern industry in agriculture or trade or manufacture could build upon it, that it made ignorance compulsory and had to do so in self-defense, and that it automatically was keeping the South from entering the great stream of modern industry where growing intelligence among workers, a rising standard of living among the masses, increased personal freedom and political power were recognized as absolutely necessary. The ethical problem here presented was less important than the political and far less than the economic. The Southerners were as little conscious of the hurt they were inflicting on human beings as the Northerners were of their treatment of the insane. It is easy for men to discount and misunderstand the suffering or harm done others. Once accustomed to poverty, to the sight of toil and degradation, it easily seems normal and natural. Once it is hidden beneath a different color of skin, a different stature, or a different habit of action and speech, and all consciousness of inflicting ill disappears. The Southern planter suffered not simply for his economic mistakes. The psychological effect of slavery upon him was fatal. The mere fact that a man could be, under the law, the actual master of the mind and body of human beings had to have disastrous effects. It tended to inflate the ego of most planters beyond all reason. They became arrogant, strutting, quarrelsome kinglets. And they issued commands, they made laws, they shouted their orders, they expected deference and self-abasement. They were choleric and easily insulted. Their honor became a vast and awful thing, requiring wide and insistent deference. Such of them as were inherently weak and inefficient were all the more easily angered, jealous, and resentful, while the few who were superior, physically or mentally, conceived no bounds to their power and personal prestige. As the world had long learned, nothing is so calculated to ruin human nature as absolute power over human beings. On the other hand, the possession of such power did not and could not lead to its continued tyrannical exercise. The tyrant could be kind and congenial. He could care for his chattels like a father. He could grant indulgence and largesse. He could play with power and find tremendous satisfaction in its benevolent use. Thus, economically and morally, the situation of the planter became intolerable. What was needed was the force of great public opinion to make him see his economic mistakes and the moral debauchery that threatened him. But here again, in the planter class, no room was made for the reformer, the recalcitrant. The men who dared such thought and act were driven out or suppressed with a virulent tyranny reminiscent of the Inquisition and the Reformation. For these, there were the same peculiar way of escape that lay before the slave. The planter who could not stand slavery followed the poor whites who could not stand Negroes. They followed the Negro, who also could not stand slavery, into the North. And there, removed from immediate contact with the evils of slavery, the planter often became the copperhead and theoretical champion of a system which he could not himself endure. Frederick Douglass thus summed up the objects of the white planter. I understand this policy to comprehend five cardinal objects. They are these. First, the complete suppression of all anti-slavery discussion. Second, the expatriation of the entire free people of color from the United States. Third, the unending perpetuation of slavery in this republic. Fourth, the nationalization of slavery to the extent of making slavery respected in every state of the Union. Fifth, the extension of slavery over Mexico and the entire South American states. This whole system and plan of development failed, and failed of its own weakness. Unending effort has gone into painting the claims of the Old South, its idyllic beauty and social charm, but the truth is inexorable. With all its fine men and sacrificing women, its hospitable homes and graceful manners, the South turned the most beautiful section of the nation into a center of poverty and suffering, of drinking, gambling, and brawling, an abode of ignorance among black and white more abysmal than in any modern land, and a system of industry so humanely unjust and economically inefficient that if it had not committed suicide in civil war, it would have disintegrated of its own weight. With the Civil War, the planters died as a class. We still talk as though the dominant social class in the South persisted after the war, but it did not. It disappeared. Just how quickly and in what manner the transformation was made, we do not know. No scientific study of the submergence of the remainder of the planter class into the ranks of the poor whites and the corresponding rise of a portion of the poor whites into the dominant portion of landowners and capitalists has been made. Of the names of prominent Southern families in Congress in 1860, only two appear in 1870, five in 1880. Of 90 prominent names in 1870, only four survived in 1880. Men talk today as though the upper class in the white South is descended from the slaveholders, yet we know by plain mathematics that the ancestors of most of the present Southerners never owned a slave, nor had any real economic part in slavery. The disaster of war decimated the planters. The bitter disappointment and frustration led to a tremendous mortality after the war, and from 1870 on, the planter class merged their blood so completely with the rising poor whites that they disappeared as a separate aristocracy. It is this that explains so many characteristics of the post-war South. Its lynching and mob law. Its murders and cruelty. Its insensibility to the finer things of civilization. Not spring. From us, no agony of birth is asked or needed. In a crimson tide upon the downslope of the world, we, the elect, are hurled in fearful power and brief pride. Burning at last, to silence and dark earth, not spring. James Rorty.